Blog Talk Radio.
Alrighty, folks, this is Rabble Rousing Rich Bergeron.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen of Tornado Land. This is the Tornado Tony Pentecost.
And I'm sure our resident lay people will be joining in on us any moment here. We got lots to cover. No guests in tonight, unfortunately, but as I told Tony earlier, we have already booked a guest for next week.
Smuggler's next week?
Smuggler's next week.
Oh, I saw your email. I was reading it at work, so I only had a few minutes. So let me get back. So let's see, Smuggler. He said, send his regards. April 10th. I see that now. I was like, oh my God, I'm going to come to see Smuggler. Oh my God, Adam, I'm going to see Smuggler tonight.
Well, I got to wait a week, unfortunately, but it's looking good. He actually he's excited about it too. So.
So what would you say? He's my favorite referee. It's true. So I think he's a hell of a referee.
Yeah. So.
The phone's response, and it was like, if I'm someone's favorite referee, then I'd be delighted to do an interview with him.
Yeah.
And it's funny. Big of the referee Steve is, he's done a lot of world title fights. Ring Magazine did a poll a few years ago, and he was rated a consensus number one referee in boxing today. But obviously, we'll talk more about him next week. But I've seen him doing a lot of local shows in the Philadelphia area. He's going to be the one tomorrow night, which I was hoping to go to, but I don't think that's going to be happening now with so much I got going on. But one of the first times I got to talk to him, I've seen Ricardo always have hi to him because he would see me. And I guess I have what they call a very familiar-looking face. I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. But he would always say hi to me. So the one time we were leaving a show, and the other referee on the card was a gentleman by the name of Gary Rosato. And Gary, I've known since my college days. He was one of the founding fathers of Lock Haven University Boxing when he became an official, and he was doing both pro and college now, so he refereed some of mine. And so we were at a Philadelphia card, and Gary was a referee, and he was really starting to really climb up the ladder, and Steve was there as the senior referee that night, I guess you would say. And we were walking out with Gary, and Steve came up, he's like, he goes, man, I've been watching you. You're one of the best young referees in boxing today. And my dad's like, dude, we've been watching him for years. We know how good he is. And he laughed. And then my dad was talking about bumping into him before a show in Philly and talking to him. And you can generally tell, as great as a referee he is, he's just as genuinely nice as a person. And that's why I'm really excited to talk to him. Like, some of his fights that I really want to talk to him about. I want to talk to him about working the Hopkins Trinidad fight 18 days after 9/11 in New York, how emotional that was, and how much of a shock to everybody that was, as Hopkins really pulled the wool over everybody's eyes and dominated that fight, knocking Trinidad out. I want to ask him what he feels it's like to be considered a fighter's referee. He's a guy that he is willing to let a fighter fight his way out of trouble. You rarely notice him for being overly intrusive, but at the same time, I honestly cannot recall anybody being hurt on his watch while he was a referee.
Well, there you go. We got Psychic Tom is with us. How's it going, Tom?
Yes, sir. And I have to add on to that, Tony. I agree with every word you said, and one more thing, you always know he's the boss, even though he doesn't have to shout it.
You're right. You are right, because you get certain referees in there, and you feel like they are not in control. You can tell he is always in control when he's in there.
Mm-hmm. And you know, it's interesting how you brought up the Trinidad-Hopkins fight. Because the one time I got to meet Steve was when he was here in my hometown in Akron back, I believe, 2004, around that time, when Clifford Etienne, the Black Rhino, knocked out Mike Shepard in the second round. And He was the ref for that one. And I got to talk to him afterwards, and he's just a prince of a man, you know, just spent some time with this man and another friend. And so I asked him about that fight. I says, well, what's the one fight at this point that's really memorable? And he was saying that Hopkins was just technically perfect that night. It was just, he lived up to his mm-hmm. name as the executioner. And that really stood out in his mind. Now, that's, I'm sure he's refereed some other ones since then. You know, this, we're going back 10 years now. But I'd still like to see, I think we're on the same page with him there, to see if he still feels that that fight stands out of all the ones that he's repped. So, yeah, this is, so is
I'm
it confirmed gonna,
I'm
now?
Bring
is
up
it,
fight, and I'm I want to bring up another fight that he refereed, and I'm sure you're going to be familiar with this one because it was a fellow Ohio native, and that was Tony the Ghost Tablet when he won the title
oh, yeah.
from Jermaine Taylor. And before that fight, and I still have it somewhere, I'll have to send you my preview on that one because mm-hmm. I took a lot of flack because I went with the Ghost. And I remember mm-hmm. my rationale going into that fight was this was, it was the card that I spoke about just a few weeks ago, featuring one of the best fights I've seen, followed by one of the worst, and it was Pavlik walking down and brutalizing a then-feared Edison Miranda. He went right to Miranda, who people were terrified of, and he just mowed him down. And then he was followed up by Jermaine Taylor fighting safety first against Corey Spinks, who hadn't knocked the guy out in like 7 years going into that fight. Mm-hmm. And I remember saying to myself, I said, first of all, Taylor was lucky to get those two wins over Hopkins. I didn't think he deserved either of them. I thought Hopkins won the first fight. That was the second fight to win that score. It was a draw. And I said he was lucky because he never beat Hopkins. He didn't beat the champion. And I guess since he was a defending champion coming in, Hopkins technically didn't beat him in the rematch. But I was like, I saw him in this fight. I didn't think he won. He was gun-shy. And then that fight against Corey Spinks, I'm like, he looked terrible. Now, Taylor goes up, he's going to fight Kelly Pavlik, and I'm sitting there going, man, this is as gun-shy as this guy is? When Pavlik puts his hands on him, it's going to be a scary thought. And people were on my shit, Tom. I swear to God. They call me, like, I don't know what I was talking about, that I was a joke. And I said, you know what, let the fight unfold. And if you go back to that first fight between those two, Taylor hit Pavlik with a right hand in the second round, and Pavlik wobbled all around the ring, and then he finally went down. He got up, and he was, I mean, his legs were complete jello. And a lot of referees would have stopped the fight because he was not only stumbling, he was actually hopping, trying to get his legs under him. It looked almost like Zab Judah when Kostya knocked him down.
Yeah.
Except his eyes were there a little bit more. And Steve let that fight go. He gave Kelly every chance he could to come back. A lot of referees, when Pavlik would stumble like that, are throwing their arms up. Fight's over. Kelly came back and won that fight in the seventh round and made me look really good in my prediction.
And I remember Steve going over to Pavlik in the corner after that second round. And Pavlik just he was adamantly saying, I'm good. So Steve let it go. And I think it's the old adage of know your fighter. And I think any referee has that obligation. And I think Steve takes it to a whole nother level. So, yeah, this is he confirmed for next week, Rich?
Yes, 8:30.
Oh, this is exciting. Yeah.
Because I guess it's funny, as I was saying when you got on, Rich is talking to me on the one email today, and Steve responded saying, well, if anybody's a big fan of me, I'll be honored to do an interview with them. And
yeah.
I guess Steve doesn't realize that me, that he's the big fan of his, is the same me that talks to him at the place all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah,
wow. Because him and my dad are like buddy-buddy with BFF.
Actually, I don't think we had a boxing referee on the show before. Except, well,
Richard Steele.
We had a couple of female MMA referees on. for that. So this is actually probably the second or third time, maybe, because we interviewed Richard twice.
I was only on with Richard at one time. That was the, we had one about 2 years ago. I remember it. Because I knew that Richard Steele, I mean, 24 years later, everybody, all they want to talk about is Chavez Taylor. And I made it a point not to bring it up just because the guy's answered the question a million and one times. He has nothing more that we can get out of it. I wanted to ask him, I wanted to go in a completely different direction, and I wanted to talk to him about Hagner Hearns because he was the referee in that fight. And I remember saying, I was like, you know, Richard, what was that like being in that such intense first round? And I remember him chuckling and saying something along the lines of, maybe that round was over because I was out of breath.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, who could ever forget that?
You know who else I think would be awesome to get on the show is another boxing referee that I would love to talk to, and I'm sure Tom would love this one also. Frank Cappuccino.
Because
I'd have three stories that within 2 seconds of saying his name, I can ask him on. One is Dottie Wood won because he was a referee, especially during that famous crazy ninth round.
Yeah.
Frank was also the referee of Tyson Spinks, which at the time was like supposed to be a colossally huge fight. It was a colossally huge destruction. And what was the other one? Oh, yeah. And I had the fight on tape somewhere. It just happened one night when I was 13 years old. It was Tuesday night fights, USA, from the Blue Horizon. And it was supposed to be George Foreman, but the fight got postponed or whatever. And it was two guys. One of them ended up going on to win a world title, Vincent Petway. He played a guy by the name of Victor Davis. You can find it on YouTube. Watch it. Great fight. Except it was one of the fights of the year, if not the fight of the year. But the best part about it was, and I had this fight on tape somewhere, that in the ninth round, as these two guys are slugging it out, the bell rang. Frank went to step in and blocked them. And they had to bring another referee in for the next round while Frank was getting his nose thumped.
Okay, Victor Davis, and who did Victor Davis fight?
Victor Davis and Vincent Petway. Vincent Petway, also, you'll find him on YouTube. He knocked out Simon Brown one time with, I think it was a counter left hook, and Brown was throwing punches while flat on his back, unconscious.
Mm.
That's my Rain Manism coming through.
Wow, we got to get to the news here and past events. Mainly big in boxing, we had the Kovalev fight over the weekend with Cedric Agnew, and Agnew got knocked out in the seventh round, but managed to cut Kovalev in the fourth round, and it was pretty interesting after the fight when Kovalev got the microphone in the post-fight interview. I'm just going to play a little clip from that here now.
Over the last 18 months, you've established yourself as, folks would say, the best light heavyweight in the world, but the light heavyweight champion, Adonis Stevenson, doesn't seem as though he wants to fight you right now for the money at this time. What do you think about that situation?
Well, that's pretty low. I mean, to call a guy like Adonis Stevenson a piece of shit, it's probably not going to help you with the fans, but might provoke a fight. And Adonis Stevenson actually has a little clip here in the same article where he provided a response. Yeah, actually, this isn't audio here, but it's Twitter posting, so I'm going to have to read them. He says, to Kovalev, tell your mama Kathy Duva to stop crying and to call Yvonne Michelle and Al Heyman to make the fight happen, bum. He also says, when Crusher Kovalev fight me, he will stay at the hospital and Mama Duva will come see him. So that to Dan Raphael, tweeted that to Dan Raphael from ESPN. So what else did he say? Koval, little boxer, you can't fight for shit. Tell Mama Duva to call Al Heyman and Yvonne Michelle.
Boy, what? I wonder what Kathy did to rub him so. For her to, for him to be mentioning her so much. Wow, that's interesting.
I don't know. It's just, boxers do this by nature sometimes. You know, even if they do like the guy, they'll kind of go back and forth like this and just think of any insult to throw at the other guy. And if he's promoted by a woman, why you call her Mama Duva?
Okay.
I think it's that big of a deal, or if anything, personal. So Kovalev looked all right, but not like a world beater anyway, against this guy Agnew, who's 26-1 now with 13 KOs. I think this is the longest he's gone in his last six fights. Six fights, so. Not the signature performance he was hoping for, but it still had the balls to call Josh Stevenson a piece of shit after it. So we'll see if he's really good when those two square off. But it looks like it's definitely going to happen because, that's usually how it goes. One guy insults the other. It happens. Anyway, the other fights on the card, we had Thomas DeLorme and Kareem Mayfield. And that was involved a cut from an accidental headbutt in the eighth round, but it went the full 10 rounds, and DeLorme won by unanimous decision, 98-92, 97-94, 96-93. Mayfield landed 21% of his punches, while DeLorme landed 27%. And DeLorme landed actually 36% of his power punches, 49 out of 135, and Mayfield only landed 21%. And light heavyweights Lionel Thompson and Radivoj Kaladzic won eight rounds. And Thompson turned it on later rounds as Kaladzic began to wear down, but it was not enough to secure the victory. Kaladzic won a split decision, with the judges scoring about 78-72 and 76-75 for Kaladzic, and 77-75 for Thompson. And Thompson had a point deduction for spitting out his mouthpiece. Not good. Well, that's pretty much it for that one. My main fights, anyway. We didn't really have any big UFC fights over the weekend. No UFC fights. But we did have Bellator. I only caught the last fight on the Bellator card. It was another win for the Russian. Can't even think of his name right now. But we do have a bunch of cards this weekend. Not UFC cards, but still big ones. We got Bellator 115 tomorrow night. And that's main event is Chuck Congo versus Vitaly Minnikov. The main event there. We'll talk about that a little later. But we also have M1 Challenge going on tomorrow. And Saturday we have, tomorrow too, Texas, we have Legacy Fighting Championship 30, which is significant because Holly Holm is headlining against Juliana Werner. Holm is 6-0, 7-3 there, and some other decent fights on that crowd we'll get to. But I want to continue on the boxing front here, and speaking of Marvin Hagler, who you just mentioned earlier, he's been in the rounds on the news this week talking about MMA, and I forget where they tracked him down for this, but he was asked about the topic of MMA. I was in Malaysia, believe it or not. Who knows why he's there. I hope he's not getting on a plane.
Yeah.
The topic of MMA came up, and here's what he had to say. That sport right there, I can't see any art inside. If you want to teach a kid how to fight in MMA, you can just take him to the bar. That's what it looks like to me. I can't understand them laying on the floor like that, and the ref don't get them up. It's terrible. But he did say that it has come a long way. He says it's really taken off. It's growing because boxing has been drifting away, so it's brought MMA into the spotlight. So that's it's been going around the MMA circle for a while. And, you know, I don't blame Marvin for thinking that way. You know, people like him, I'd like to see him, instead of saying boxing is drifting away, you know, try to do something about it. He's actually kind of avoided the limelight over the years and lived overseas for most of the time and really doesn't go to a heck of a lot of events here in the United States. And not much brings him back, so it's kind of unfortunate.
Yeah, it's kind of sad because I don't think he ever got over losing to Leonard. He never accepted the judge's verdict in that, ever. And I don't know, it's just a shame to see his legacy. I mean, not that I think that diminished it, but I think in his eyes more than anything. I mean, he just walked away, and that was it.
Exactly. Now, we just talked about, too, Curry Mayfield had a losing battle the other night. Manager of Mayfield is a guy named Marlon Sullivan, and Sullivan was actually arrested last Wednesday morning on charges that were related to the arrest of California State Senator Leland Yee. And I don't know how much you guys watch the news, but you might have seen lately there's been a few different people across the United States recently who were arrested on big charges, and this one was the biggest of the big. Senator Yee was communicating with some FBI agent, and he said he would deliver $2 million in cash, the FBI agent, and basically he wanted weapons in exchange, and shoulder-fired automatic weapons, equivalent to the M16, and asked about the availability of shoulder-fired missiles and rockets. And he arranged this all and said he would get him the guns. And then, of course, you know, there was a sting and he got busted. But Sullivan was arrested for being wrapped up in something else involving his arrest, which was a murder-for-hire plan. And also, I guess, charges of dealing with firearms without a license and a conspiracy to distribute narcotics. So Sullivan is actually a friend of Brandon Jackson, who's the son of a political consultant to Senator Yee. And he actually also is accused of selling weapons and body armor to an undercover FBI agent, which was reportedly to raise money for Yee. Great idea. he also is accused of providing the agent with fraudulent credit cards, the keys for which he had purchased with bitcoins from a supplier in Russia. And on another occasion, according to the affidavit, Sullivan described their narcotics trafficking, including transporting marijuana to the East Coast in Tennessee. Jackson and Sullivan were interested in the undercover agent assisting them by providing transportation assistance and supplying them with cocaine and other hard drugs to sell on their established routes. And Sullivan also agreed to carry out a murder-for-hire plot, which he said would be, quote, easy work, and added, I will put eyes on the guy and have my boy knock him down. And Sullivan then surveilled the potential victim at a restaurant to gain physical description. It was pretty crazy stuff. I don't know if that guy's going to be managing anything except for his prison canteen account. So how he's going now. But that's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and ironically, he apparently he was a big supporter of gun control legislation, from what I understand. Supreme irony here.
That's not the only place where boxing's making big news, because it looks like Vitaly Klitschko is not going to be running for the presidency of the Ukraine, and he's going to instead throw his support behind the billionaire. And he will, though, stick with politics. Apparently, he's going to run for the mayor of Ukraine's capital city, Kiev. And the guy he's favoring in the presidential race is a guy named Petro Poroshenko. So he's the big guy stepping out of the presidential race there. And he's a mayor.
Honestly, I don't believe it. I don't want to be afraid of anything in politics. Much better right now. And you feel like you can really help out. You can really do good things. You can turn things around. But for now, you make it more fast.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it seems like the Russians have been kind of playing games over there with the on the border. And it's probably not going to get any better in the next few months, but Kiev is pretty far from the border, so hopefully Vladimir stays, or Vitaly stays out of the fray there for a little while. Doesn't look like he's going to be going back to boxing anytime soon, though. I know Manny Pacquiao can do politics and boxing at the same time, but he's really a mayor. He's a senator over there. So I would think it'd be harder to be a mayor at the same time as you're trying to do a boxing career, especially when you're training all the time in Germany. You're going to be a mayor in Kiev when you're in Germany all the time. Well, I guess that's what Vladimir said, but I don't know where Vitaly would be. He still kept up his career. Anyway, speaking of the Klitschkos, I sent you guys a little clip the other day of Vladimir Klitschko getting hit by a shoe. And it was actually a pretty heated situation there with Shannon Briggs calling him out, basically saying that all he did was fight bums. And so what happened was they started arguing. He didn't really look to be really trying to go at Vladimir. He was just trying to talk and look all buff and tough. Basically, he just ripped off his shirt and was picking back and forth, and he kept moving towards Vladimir, but, you know, Vladimir's people, who were much smaller than Briggs, just kept kind of pushing him away and keeping him back. So Briggs took off one of his shoes and whipped it at Vladimir while he was getting his hands wrapped, and Vladimir just sat there and said nothing, and I actually did... check out the response from Vladimir, and also FightNews.com did an interview with Shannon Briggs after the fact, and he explained this. Exactly what Vladimir said is what bothered him. Vladimir mentioned that he saw him at some fight in the area and basically gave him the fist bump instead of stopping and saying hello to him, because he was on the phone with his brother and had his headphones on and they were talking, and I guess Shannon Briggs walked by him and said, hello, what's up, champ, or something like that. And he obviously looks very different now, if you've seen the video. He doesn't have his dreadlocks or his long coloring there. He's totally bald. So, Klitschko, he didn't recognize him. And so...
I think Jonathan Banks looked a little bit annoyed there. He was sitting there. He wanted to get up and look his ass.
Yeah. But, you know, it was just one of those situations where it's like, you know, what a stupid thing to argue over and try to pick a fight about. But Shannon Briggs just basically felt disrespected because the guy didn't stop and talk to him. But I don't know if these two will ever fight, because I would think Briggs would have to really string together a bunch of big wins over some major competition to make that happen. And not only that, he's demanding the fight to be at Barclays Center in Brooklyn. Ain't no way, frickin', that Vladimir Klitschko would come all the way to the United States for a fight and not do it in Vegas. I mean, if he's going to do it, he's going to do it in Vegas.
Yeah, he's going to do it. He's going to do it. And that's funny. It's like, you know, there's a guy that has no money that wants to plan the big event. It's like me walking up to Donald Trump right now and be like, hey, Donald, me and you are going to schedule this weekend, and we're going to schedule it wherever, and I'm going to get the top billing. Well, you know, that's not going to happen, you know? Look at me and say, you're fired. So I do, but that, you're fired. But that's similar to what it's like. Okay, yeah, I want a shot as a champ. Okay, you're not even ranked. I want a shot as a champ, and I want it in Brooklyn. Okay. Vladimir's going to, you know, Vladimir might say, you know what? I'm going to come to Brooklyn and whoop your ass in front of your friends and family. You threw a shoe at me. Yeah, I'll put my glove so far down your throat, you can chew at your own ass for pissing me off.
Well, actually, Vladimir did say you're going to eat that shoe. So maybe he does think he can beat him, and maybe it will happen. But, you know, right now he keeps facing these mandatory challengers. And, he's got this fight with Alex Lapai coming up, who isn't really, you know, up to par, I don't think, to beat him, but I wouldn't call him a bum either, so I think Briggs is a little out of the line there, but it's definitely going to take a lot more to convince anyone that he's ready to come back. Obviously, he has the pedigree to do it, and he claims that he never took it seriously before now, and now he's taking it seriously, and he just played at boxing before, and now he's really, really doing it. And he looks good. He said he lost about 130 pounds, and he definitely seems to be, you know, working hard at it. He went all the way to Germany to the same facility where Vladimir is training to get his career back on track. And he actually is one of the guys who beat George Foreman during his comeback. So
that was a nonsense. Foreman won that fight.
That was the reality of fighting over 40, I guess.
Briggs won that fight about as much as Bradley won that first fight with Pacquiao. That's the honest God truth. And, I mean, Briggs always like, you know, hey, you win a fight like that, okay, of course you're going to be proud, but at the same time, you got to be realistic. You lost the fight, and that was, what, 17 years ago? Does the guy still think he's vital? I mean, I know I'm not, you know, that much of an Einstein, but come on.
Well, I doubt it's going to happen anytime soon, if it happens at all, but I wouldn't be surprised if they put it together and within a couple of years, if Briggs really comes out with a vengeance here. He waited a little less time for the comeback than George did, so maybe that's a good thing. We'll see. Anyway, that's great. We've got some MMA stuff to cover, of course. Big fight last Saturday night on World Series of Fighting, and of course our boy there, Usmar Paul Harez, back in the controversy. People saying again that he held on to a dangerous leg lock for a little too long after his opponent tapped out, but this time the president of his organization is sticking up for him. Instead of Dana White throwing him out after the last time something like this happened, Ray Sifo, who is the former fighter who was in charge of World Series of Fighting, actually said that the submission happened right in front of him, and he said, I thought as soon as the referee told him to let go, he let go. So if you think that he held it too long, then you're crazy. So it is what it is.
I haven't seen it, Rich. Have you seen it?
No, I didn't watch it at all.
Okay, I don't know if it's on YouTube, but I haven't had time to look for it, but I'll have to do it and, you know, check it out and see what I think.
Well, he ended up winning the fight. He got the championship belt, and he's 16-6 overall now. But it is what it is. I mean, there's only so much you can say. in defense of somebody who does that on purpose, but I don't think he ever even did the one that he got thrown out of the UFC for on purpose. Number one, there's usually, with these Brazilian guys, there's usually some kind of language gap, even though tapping is not really a language. When somebody taps out, you should know it, but, you know, countless times in fights you see guys tap and the other guy didn't even realize he taps, didn't even feel it, or he doesn't see it, or whatever, however it happens, and the referee might not see it. So I think with Palhares, it's just misunderstandings and stupid mistakes. I don't think it was anything like when they kicked out Renato Sobral for holding a rear naked choke on the guy too long, and when he admitted after the fight that he wanted to send the guy a message. In this case, Palhares has never looked like he did anything intentionally or on purpose or out of spite. It's just, that's the way it happened. That's the way it unfolded. So, looks like he's got a new home there in the World Series of Fighting, and it'll be all right. And speaking of being all right, Robbie Lawler is back in the news. He's going to be stepping back into the cage very soon. It's UFC 173. And he's actually stepping in for another Strikeforce convert, Tarek Safadine, who was supposed to face Jake Ellenberger. Safadine is out. It's going to be Lawler versus Ellenberger at UFC 173, even though Safadine was supposed to go against Ellenberger at 172 on April 26th. So now it's going to be May 24th. UFC 173, Lawler versus Ellenberger. Pretty interesting fight there. And UFC 173 has been really changed by injuries. The original fight that was supposed to be at the top there was going to be Chris Weidman against Vitor Belfort in the main event. Belfort was replaced by Lyoto Machida. And after the PRT ban, then Weidman elected to have surgery on a knee injury. So now it's going to be UFC 175 for that fight. And then Renan Barão and TJ Dillashaw were put on the card. And now Lawler versus Ellenberger. So, see how that one goes. And we got a guy back in the news, Scott Smith, back in the news for all the wrong reasons here this week. Guess he's having a real bad battle with alcoholism. And fell off the wagon late in 2013. And now he's trying to clamp back down, quit again. So he's been sober for about 3 or 4 months. And unfortunately for him, he says that actually the experience of watching fights and being around fighters just makes him want to drink more, because he realizes how close he was, especially recently. He said a couple weeks ago when Robbie Lawler fought Johnny Hendricks, he said, Lawler is somebody I fought. I was on the same level as him for a little bit. So things like that, people, places, things, I just didn't want to watch the fight. I was rooting for him, wanting him to win, read it online. But I'd just rather distance myself from things that might be a trigger. And he is training again. Feels like he still has a fight left in him. But he's 34 years old, so, you know, time's ticking. And he said it's a daily battle, but this anti-craving medication I just started when I went into a detox house a month ago is helping. It's a non-narcotic, non-benzo, because I don't like medication at all. So it's nothing that would show up on a drug test. It's actually helping. And good luck to him. We'll see what happens with him, but alcoholism is no joke. He's one of those guys famous for the comeback.
You know, a lot of people don't think that can be a problem, but I've run into people that cannot control it. I had an issue back when I was late in college, and I was struggling with it for a while, especially when I wasn't boxing for the university anymore, and still had a semester before I graduated, and I didn't know what to do with myself. So, yeah, I had a problem with that. And I remember Dr. Cox even said it to one time. And when he said it, I thought it was funny, and it wasn't. And now I can go out, I can have a good time. I don't have to, you know, there are times I'll go weeks or months at a time before without having a drink, which is good. And I do it more for social events now. But, yeah, I know how scary that can be. And I remember a former training partner of mine, we hadn't seen each other in a while I was recouping from my hand injury. And I came back, and he was happy to see me. And it's the way you were going for a while, he goes, I was afraid you were dead. I'll wake you up.
Well, yeah, that sucks.
It's got
we know the sad saga of Kelly Pavlik, who we were just talking about at the beginning of the show. He gets in a fight with a cab driver and passes out in court. He's not doing too well. And he tried to come back, and it didn't work. Went back on to the alcohol kick, so definitely sucks. And we didn't have guys still fighting. Or should still be fighting. Now he's not in communication with his bosses. Tito Ortiz has got a big car wreck. But that's another story here. Tito Ortiz is waiting for the phone to ring now. Because he says he's ready. He's already into training camps after his neck injury. And he was already expected to battle Griffin Jackson last November. Now he says he's 100% healthy. He says everything is good. I'm about my ninth week of training. I'm kind of on hold right now, waiting for Bellator to send me up for the match. I thought I'd be on this pay-per-view that's coming up, but they wanted to wait. I told them I want to fight. I told them I'm ready to go. And I left it to them to get it done. I'm just training and waiting for the call. When they call, I'm ready. Whoever it is, I don't care. But there's no guarantee the phone will ring. Bellator's Bjorn Ripley is afraid that Ortiz could be facing paralysis after a 15-year career that has been riddled with injuries and insists there isn't a definitive answer in terms of when he could come back. So, obviously we know Ortiz is just 1-7-1 since his win over Ken Shamrock back in 2005. At 59 years old, he's running out of time. But, he does have a new girlfriend. But he has a nice shoulder to cry on. And speaking of injuries, too, George St. Pierre can't stay out of the gym. Now he's torn his ACL. He's not even fighting right now, or preparing for a fight, so. Tells you how serious he is about getting back something. But he's actually pretty nonchalant about it, obviously because, you know, nobody's going to have to cancel a fight over it this time. He said on Twitter, tore my left ACL in training, surgery in a few days, rehab, pain, hard work, no shortcuts. I'll soon be back at 100%. Thanks for the support. It is not the same knee that required reconstructive surgery in December of 2011, so it might be a quicker recovery this time. See what happens. Good luck. Could you just be there? Let's see what else we got. Pretty interesting story about Michael Bisping and Tim Kennedy. And they've been trash-talking each other, but they do actually see eye-to-eye on testosterone replacement therapy, according to this. So he's actually, Tim Kennedy came out with a statement about it. And he says, we both share the same feelings about testosterone replacement therapy, which was recently banned by the Nevada State Athletic Commission. But he hates it because he lost the three guys who were medically prescribed to use it. Dan Ingerson, Chael Sonnen, and Vitor Belfort. I hate it because I hate cheap. even though I'm not actively fighting in the U.S. Army following my years of service at the beginning of 2004, I'm still part of the military guard and frequently different steroids. So it's not the USG or any athletic commission that tests me for drugs. It's the military. And actually, kind of funny, when I read that, I immediately thought of my time at the U.S. Air Force Academy. And they tested me like four times in my freshman year. And you had to get up at like 5 a.m. to go with these people to one of the bathrooms and, you know, do the piss test. And I got cleared every time. You know, obviously wasn't taking anything. But they still kept calling me for drug tests. Like, they had something to suspect, though. First of all, I'm a freshman. I can't even leave campus, and I won't know any upperclassmen who would give me drugs. So, I don't know where they were getting that idea. But they called it random. They definitely take it seriously. But, actually, he goes on to say, Jim Kennedy, that he's been a professional athlete for 13 years and been with almost every single fight camp that exists. And he has friends that fight with different camps, and he's not an idiot when he talks about drugs and MMA. What is? He says, in our sport, you have to go to make the earning potential of possibly your entire life. And in that window, you have to do everything you can to get as many wins in the most exciting fashion that you can to increase that earning potential. The ones who use performance-enhancing drugs are trying to make easy money. They want it all, but they don't want the pain that goes along with earning it the right way. They want the watches, the big-boobed blondes hanging out with them at parties, but they don't want to make the sacrifices to get better. So they just grab a needle, dip it in blood, and go for a workout. I have been approached countless times about doing it, but I've never done it because I have character. I'm not a cheat. I think doing performance-enhancing drugs goes against everything about what this sport is founded on, and that's martial arts, being disciplined, focused, and responsible. Those are the reasons I'm a martial artist. So basically, he goes on to talk a little bit more about TRT, and he said he's glad that Bisping is against it too, because of his media presence in the sport and that people listen to him. And, of course, you have to take a shot at him at the final sentence of the statement. He says, but I can't help but think he is only against TRT because of those losses to fighters who are on TRT. But whatever your thoughts on that, as I've said time and time again, I don't really think it's the end of TRT use. It's just the end of the sanction and the system where people can be tested for it or using it legitimately, so to speak. Well, we talked a little bit last week about that testing situation, too, with the Voluntary Anti-Doping Association. And we talked about Lorenzo Fertitta shooting down the idea of involving a third party. And Fertitta told ESPN, I think we have to understand at the end of the day we are unlike other sports. We are regulated and cannot be presumptuous. Thinking we can just take away whatever authority commissions have and put it in our hands. It's not that simple. So actually, VADA, by way of Bloody Elbow, provided a little bit of a response to Fertitta, and they said, to date, commissions have accepted and reviewed our results irrespective of conducting their own testing. VADA notifies commissions, the ABC, the promoter, and the fighter as results are obtained. It is the role of the commission to adjudicate those results. VADA's only role is to facilitate testing and educate the participants. Unannounced year-round PED testing of all UFC athletes can be done if the promoter or another entity is willing to fund the program, but it takes considerable time and forethought to have it done correctly, uniformly, fairly. It goes beyond funding. Athletes must have complete knowledge of the program's procedures, policies, and results management. Irrespective of funding, few commissions have the manpower to institute a year-round program of all licensees. When the UFC holds events outside a commission's jurisdiction, they are acting as a third party and adjudicator. We remain available to promotional organizations like the UFC when they hold contests and test athletes where there is no commission. When commissions arrange testing, it should be independent of any specific recommendations by the promotional company. So they also add that it's important to keep the discussion at the forefront. This continues to be the ADA's goal, along with our scientific director, Dr. Don Catlin, who independently certifies the results. We continue to advise many athletic commissions and physicians worldwide regarding expanding their PED testing protocols. Both Dr. Flip Homansky, the ADA's VP, and myself have known Mr. Fertitta for many years. We would be happy to meet with him at any time to detail not only our program, but discuss what the ADA and how PEDA education can be expanded to all the UFC athletes. And the Nevada State Athletic Commission has dealt with third-party drug testing on numerous occasions, according to this article, and they have a history of dealing with failed VADA drug tests in cases such as Lamont Peterson, ahead of his 2012 bout with Amir Khan. There you have it there. So Fertitta's kind of been given the talking to there, and they also, you know, extend an invitation that you can sit down with them anytime. And I think they actually, a few months ago, put out an estimate that it would cost a little over $1 million for this type of program, for the BADA to do it themselves. And as far as the value of the UFC, Dana White apparently is upping. He actually says now that the whole thing is worth something around $3.5 billion, according to a recent interview with Financial Times. And Lorenzo Fertitta actually was the last one to put a value on the UFC a few years ago. He said it would be about $2 billion. But that was a few years ago. And it makes sense that it would go up $1.5 billion. In that time, in their eyes anyway, but I don't think anybody would actually buy it for that price if they were willing to sell it. About $3.5 billion, and that would make it worth more than a lot of different major sports teams, including the New York Yankees. So we'll see if that ever, if we ever see a sale. Find out if it's worth that much, but as of now, they keep their numbers private, so we don't know. As I said, Chris Weidman is going to be undergoing minor knee surgery, so that's postponed his Lyoto fight. He actually, I think, already had it now. This was from last week. I think they did it pretty quickly. Now, here's a story we didn't really get the chance to talk about last week. And that is Ronda Rousey's next opponent. We kind of brushed the topic, but we didn't really get into painting the full picture. Because we kind of just discussed Gina Carano possibly coming back to the sport and her remarks about that subject, but one thing that she said really puzzled me, because she kind of seems to indicate that she'd only come back if it was the right opportunity. And she also says kind of the same things that Joe Rogan was saying a few weeks ago. I wish I could tell you what's going on. And she actually says, I feel like I can't say too much. Got all this information that if I could just speak freely, this is actually what's going on. I wish I could open up my mind and tell you exactly the things that I've seen and the conversations that I've had, but I think to sum it up in a nice way for me is if circumstances were right and if it's a good enough circumstances, I would come back because my first love is MMA. Now, it would be hard to believe that Gina would come back immediately to face Rousey, just like that. Obviously, the fight could be made. Will be made if they're agreeable to it, but I would not bet on Carano to come back and want to go up against the champion right away. I would think she'd want at least one official fight under the UFC belt before going right for the championship, or under the UFC banner. So we'll see. I just really, I'm doubtful about this, but the way she's prefaced those statements, I can't say too much. It seems to me that Rogan was trying to say that, you know, the stuff he couldn't talk about was related to Gina Carano. So something's going on, I think. We just don't know what. But she did also add, I've never retired. I've never officially said that. For some reason, a part of me has always kept it open. I don't know. There's a certain part of me that thinks the circumstances are right and I can keep doing what I'm trying to make my future into. That's an ideal world. If circumstances are right, you never know. I'm very open to it. And she's going to be 32 years old in a few weeks and has had some struggles with making the 145-pound featherweight limit. She's also got conflicts with Hollywood. She's been in a few movies. Not really anything blockbuster yet, but no Oscars or anything. But it's not out of the realm of possibility. She comes up with, and I'm pretty sure paychecks are probably better for movies than they are for fights. But you never know. I mean, if they are worth $3.5 million, I'm sure they could throw $1 million at her to get back in the ring, the cage. But she also adds, I haven't trained for a fight in a long time, so it gets kind of interesting when you start coming up. But if I ever did do something like that, I would want the circumstances to be correct and right. I would definitely take something like that extremely seriously. I would dedicate myself to it and need the time because you're taking somebody who hasn't fought in a while, that hasn't been in a fight camp type environment, and it would have to be done at a time where there would be enough time for me to get ready for that and be able to support myself during that time, because that's all I'd be doing, is taking that seriously. And it would take me away from other projects or potential projects that I've worked this far in my life to get to. So it's not out of the question, but it seems to be highly unlikely at this point. She's coming back. And we talked about drug testing. John Jones is for actually asking for more drug testing, extra drug testing, for his next fight with Teixeira. He had a media day at Jackson's MMA. And he said he requested and received additional drug testing ahead of his light heavyweight title defense against Glover Teixeira, the main event of UFC 172. It's going to take place later this month, April 26th. And he explained, Maryland's commission sent the lab to drug test me, and I'm glad they did it. It was urine and blood that tests for HGH, I think, and a urine test that can detect all sorts of other stuff. It was something that me and my management team asked for several months ago because we thought it would be great to make sure everyone was playing fair in this fight. I'm not accusing my opponent of anything, but it would just be great to see, and the UFC approved it. They never told me or Glover when the test would come, but mine came today, and I'm happy that it came. It's great to know that the athletes who are competing are clean. I've never taken any kind of performance-enhancing drug, and I don't think any of my opponents should. I probably fought people in the past who have, and I still found a way to come out and win. I want to see our sport be a clean sport. I want to see our athletes have pride and hard work, and that's why I thought I'd put my money where my mouth is. I have no right to accuse Glover of being on anything, but I know when people get chances to fight for world titles, maybe they'll do anything to get an itch, and I think the only itch you should have is your work ethic. And, of course, Teixeira has never tested positive for any banned substances, and neither has Jones in their entire careers. But, as Jones said, with so much on the line, might as well go the extra mile. And in addition to the pre-fight screening, Jones and Teixeira will also be required to provide samples immediately after their fight. So that's it. I guess the UFC didn't want to create another George St. Pierre situation with Jones when he asked for this, so this seemed to be coming around to this thing. And hopefully Jones takes a leadership role on stuff like this a little more often and makes his opinions known. Let's see, here's a story about sponsorship dollars drying up. Last few months, we saw Mac Danzig actually retired after one of his last fights. He wore a blank pair of white shorts with the words "Not for Sale" printed in large black font across the back of them, and that was against Joe Lauzon and televised on Fox. Prior to the fight, Danzig voiced his complaints about the lack of sponsorship dollars and explained he was not going to under-evaluate his work. Other fighters, including former UFC fighter Nate Quarry, current UFC fighter Chris Camozzi, current Bellator fighter Quentin Rampage Jackson, have all voiced their concerns about sponsorship evaluations. And when the UFC switched networks and moved from Spike TV to Fox, it was a landmark for the world of MMA, but with the bigger network, they figured sponsorship figures would increase, and to some extent they were right, but the majority consensus is that sponsorship figures have decreased tremendously since the UFC entered into their agreement with Fox. Certain sponsors, such as the gun store, are no longer allowed inside the UFC octagon, and that was due to the audience being more children and young adults on Fox. That was actually a casualty of that deal. They had a certain image to maintain, and the gun store was not part of that demographic. And the frequency of fight cards is another problem. In 2013, the UFC held 33 events, and Bellator held 24, including other promotions that aired on television, such as Resurrection Fighting Alliance, Legacy Fighting Championship, World Series of Fighting. The number of MMA features has experienced tremendous growth. Sponsors are able to pick and choose the fighters along with the events they want to sponsor. That significantly decreases the opportunities and leverage managers have to pursue sponsorship deals. And at the bottom, at the end of the day, I guess they believe that some money is better than no money, and that leads to ridiculously low evaluations of a fighter's worth. Companies can tell managers and fighters, why would I pay you $1,500 to sponsor your opponent or another fighter on the same card for $300? Fighters and managers are having such a hard time securing sponsors that they are undercutting each other to lock in the same deals. Once a manager or fighter hears a dollar amount that another fighter got for a similar event, they will undercut that fighter and that dollar amount in order to secure the sponsorship. So that's what it's turning into, according to this piece. That's unfortunate for these guys because I know a lot of them rely on that to train. The UFC pays such shitty dollars to these preliminary guys.
So much for a level playing field if some guys are sponsored and other guys aren't. There we go. Right back to the someone's got a job and someone doesn't. But it's a level playing field if we have drug testing. Thank God. It's a load off my mind.
Now, we got some events coming up this weekend. Tomorrow, actually, we got three. I'm going to go through the lists of three big fighting events. We got Bellator first from Reno, Nevada. And we've got, as I said earlier, Vitaly Minnikov. He's undefeated at 13-0, fighting Czech Congo, who's 20 wins, 8 losses, and 2 draws. We've got Johnny Cisneros, 8-2, versus Mikel Parlo, who's 11-2. Volkan Ozdemir, undefeated at 10-0, fighting Kelly Anunsen, who's 6-2. Herman Tirado versus Justin Baseman. Herman is 11-3. Justin is 14-4. We got James Terry versus Rick Reeves. Terry is 13-6. Reeves is 9-4. We got Freddie Aquitania, 6-1, versus Josh Appelt, who's 10-2. And a couple pro debuts going on. Three pure debuts, to be exact. The second fight of the night is two guys making their debuts, Jason Powell and Sinjin Smith. And the first fight is Oscar Ramirez, who's 2-0, facing Benito Lopez, who's making his pro debut. And we have, as I said, Legacy Fighting Championship 30 going on tomorrow night in Texas. This Legacy Fighting Championship must be based in Texas, but the fight is going to be in Albuquerque, which is where Holly usually fights in New Mexico. Main events, Holly Holm, 6-0, versus Juliana Werner, who's 7-3. You also have Donald Sanchez, who's 29-13. A heck of a record. Facing a guy with an even better record, Flavio Alvaro, who's 46-10. He's no Travis Fulton, but that's a lot of fights. Ray Borg is also on this card. He's 5-0, fighting Nick Urso, who's 7-1. Enrique Briones is 13-4, fighting Adrian Cruz, who's 5-1. Clint Roberts, 4-2, fighting Martin Sano, who's 3-0. Lenny Lovato, 8-2, fighting Kamaruddin Usman, who's 3-1. Mikey Lovato, also on the card, 10-3, facing Gene Perez, who's 3-6. And Stacey Kly will make her pro debut against, he will make his pro debut against Eric Saavedra, 3-5. Stacy's another one of those names. It could be a guy's name. Well, no, I've never heard of a Stacy being a guy. All right, then we have over in Russia, we have the big M1 Challenge number 47. Main event is Murat Gafurov, 8-0, versus Lee Morrison, who's 13-3. Co-main event there is Jeff Monson, who's 49-17-1. Facing Chaban Ka, who's 6-3-1. And we also have Marcin Tybura, who's undefeated at 9-0, fighting Mauro Perak, who's 23-3-1. We've got Ivan Buckinger, who's 25-4, fighting Sergey Goliev, who is 23-10. Julian Williams, 4-1, fighting Rasul Abdulayev, who's 3-0. Camille Marron was 4-1, fighting Georgi Fursov, who's 1-0. And the first fight of the night will be Luis Fernando Miranda, 11-1, facing Vasily Babich, 10-3. And, let's see. I sent you, Tony, I think, Tom, to the Super 8 tournament page recently. That is shaping up. We've got 5 out of the 8 fighters already set up to go. And it's looking good. It's looking like something that...
Yeah, I saw that, and I can't say I've been a big fan of the way that they've been doing this, all like, you know, the stuff on ESPN and all that. I haven't really been able to get into it that much, the tournament style, and I've seen it fight, and I think it's different. It's not getting a whole lot of publicity. I know they're trying to, you know, get ideas from MMA and things like that, or doing anything they can to, get fans out there, anything to get people interested. But, you know, you're looking at some of the guys, the two of the ones I remember off the top of my head, Sally Meehan, Daniel Peter. I remember these guys back thinking they were one back about 4 or 5 years ago. You know, I haven't thought of Sally Meehan probably since about 2006. You know, I wish him all the best of luck. It's not something I'm tremendously interested in.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, even though these guys aren't, in the title picture right now for the heavyweight division, they're big names for the sport. They've been around. They have pretty decent records. Just about all of them have over 30 wins except for Martin Rogan so far. Ireland, but he's been more active more recently, so I think it's a good idea, but you can only imagine what it would be like if they put up more money, because right now they're only offering $500,000, and that's the total purse. If you look at the rules and the bracket, it shows you exactly how it's supposed to be laid out, how the tournament's supposed to be set up. You're going to have, obviously, 4 fights at the beginning, down to 2 fights, down to 1 fight. And in the first stage, everybody gets $15,000. Second stage, everybody gets $30,000. Third stage, winner gets $100,000, I guess, or both guys get $100,000. And the winner gets $200,000 out of the last fight. So he'll actually make, let's see, $345,000 total if he wins every fight. Now, it's all in one night, so you're going to have two people are going to fight three times that night. And the other six will fight twice. Or four. But it's called Last Man Standing. They're also saying there's going to be over $80,000 in fight bonuses. Which I don't know what they're talking about, but... Oh, I guess throughout the evening it says fighters can receive bonuses for knockouts, best fights, and fight of the night, bringing the total prize pool up to $500,000. I know they did this in Monte Carlo. They tend to do this overseas in places because the rules are different. The Monte Carlo one was not a one-night deal, though. And I think there's only four people in that one. So this is a little bit bigger undertaking, bigger guys, obviously. We'll have to see who the other three guys are before I put my final stamp of approval or disapproval on it. But they seem to have really gotten the word out quick. I just saw this on a blurb the other day. And actually, yesterday, I got an email trying to sell me tickets to it. So, pretty interesting. But... we will definitely try to communicate with these folks and get some of these fighters on the show in the future to talk about it before it goes down. But it's June 4th, so we got plenty of time to see how it develops. I'm excited about it. I think it's going to be a good deal. May not be the best guys in the world, but I'm hoping that that tournament format catches on, because I think it's... pretty intriguing.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to prepare for that because, you know, the old cliche that in fighting there's always the X factor, the unknown, that you just don't know what'll happen. And in this case, the unknown is so big it's an opponent in and of itself. I mean, you don't know if your opponent's going to win easy and you're going to have a tough fight. So, yeah, it just brings back a lot of memories from the old beginning days of the UFC.
Yeah, well, I mean, Tony and I were in tournaments in boxing. Well, he was in more than I have been, but, you know, at the national tournament there, you never fought on the same day. I mean, you had one fight, and then the next day you had another fight. So even in boxing, there's typically a lot less concussion type situations. It's a classic way to determine a champion, you know, in different, lot more, you see it a lot more in the amateurs, of course, but I'd like to see it more in the pros, and I'd like to see it, see this thing be successful so it, it attracts more interest in this type of thing, because I think, even though it's only three rounds at a time, and it is kind of like, amateur style, these guys have been in enough fights where they should be able to handle it.
There's something like this about 12, 13 years ago. Lots of heavyweights were in it. And the only reason I knew about it was there were some up-and-comers, some guys that were on the down 5 minutes there, three strange contenders in there. And the only reason I knew about it was a friend of mine was in it, Gerald Jedi Noble. This was before Gerald got the fight on the Roy Jones and Tony Taja on the card. And, you know, Gerald was a good fighter. He wasn't getting the breaks he needed. He had a couple of keeping himself in shape sometimes. And they were having a round robin tournament. And I forget how it played out. I never did it. I think it was all done in one night where it was done on, like a pay-per-view type format. And it had, I forget how many total guys in it. They're all like three-round fights. And the guy that won it was a guy by the name of Maurice Mo Harris. And Gerald beat him earlier in his career, earlier when they met up, and Gerald knocked him out. And Maurice won the series, and he might beat Gerald during it because he was able to play an amateur type style and play keep away for three rounds and win. And it was, you know, I remember the whole thing was a flop. I know the pay-per-view buy rate was not good. I didn't order it. I remember reading about it in Ring Magazine, thinking, what the hell was this, the gimmick, and not ordering it. And I remember reading the results and it not being impressive. It didn't, and the thing is, it did not count against the guy's pro record. So Gerald was undefeated at the time. Now, he lost his fight to Maurice Patterson there. He didn't go against his pro record. So it was really gimmicky. And, I mean, I don't know how this is going to be, how different this is going to be, but it's too gimmicky.
Yeah. Well, I remember we talked about something similar to this that never actually happened, a Super Fighter tournament. I think that was supposed to be in Australia. And all kinds of people were behind that. So we'll see. I mean, I'd be happy to try to publicize it, get the word out, and interview fighters and stuff for it. But, you know, it is kind of an experiment, no matter what way you look at it. And it's not the traditional way of going about things. So a lot of boxing purists will probably feel the same way and say, yeah, I'm going to skip this one. But it'd be nice, I think, to just to see how these guys do, and if they obviously don't have anything better to do, so why not see if they still got it. We got some fights coming up this weekend, big fights. Actually, tomorrow night, big Kathy Duva main events, and J. Russell Peltz and your buddy Brittany Rogers are all coordinating for a big event at the La Cora Center in Philadelphia. And Steve,
yeah, I wanted to say that, and then I said, like, everything just kind of fell apart.
We got super middleweight main event, Curtis Stevens, 26-4 with 19 knockouts, fighting Toriano Johnson, who's undefeated at 14-0 with 10 knockouts. And
I think the real main event is Steve Cunningham and Amir Mansour.
Yeah.
Out of the local heavyweight, that's going to be the big attraction.
That's for the USBA heavyweight title. I mean,
he better go on land.
20-0 with 15 knockouts. Fighting Cunningham is 26-6 with 12 knockouts. Although I think most of those six defeats came at light heavyweight or cruiserweight.
And I was reading a colleague of mine that was writing about this. And one thing he pointed out, what's going to be interesting, it's going to be a contrast of styles. Steve is a traditional, he's more of a boxer puncher. He's a guy that, now he's got more power than his knockout percentage would show, but he's not a traditional puncher. He did floor Tyson Fury in a fight before Fury just used his about 70-pound weight advantage to wear Cunningham down. But Steve is, he's a sharp puncher. He's got a better punch than his knockout record suggests. But overall, he's not a big puncher. He's not a guy that you're going to get a lot of highlight reel knockouts from. Now, you got Amir Mansour. He's a bigger guy. He's a more physical guy. He's considered more of a puncher. So now, if you got a guy that's more considered a puncher boxer in Mansour and a guy that's a boxer puncher in Cunningham, the question is, what guy is going to be able to execute his game plan? The experience goes to Cunningham. The being able to get up off the canvas and win in a tough fight goes to Cunningham. The youth, the fighter that's a little bit fresher, that hasn't been in the wars, gotta get a man tall. What guy is going to be able to establish the game plan early, force his opponent out of his comfort zone, force him into doing things he does not want to do? That is the guy that will win that fight.
All right. We got a couple other fights worth mentioning, at least one here. Edner Cherry is fighting an 8-round welterweight fight against Robert Osiobi. Cherry is 31-6-2 with 17 knockouts. Ostiobi is 14-8-4 with 6 knockouts. Cruiserweights on this card also undefeated cruiserweights. We've got Mike Lee, 11-0 with 6 knockouts, fighting Peter Lewison, who's 6-0 with 5 knockouts. So that's on the undercard there. If you're in Philly, like Tony, this Friday night, you can watch it. If not, you can watch it on NBC Sports.
NBC Sports,
yes.
Unless things change till tomorrow afternoon.
Can't hear you, Tony. Speak up.
I said, unless things change by tomorrow afternoon, unfortunately, that's what I'll likely have to be doing. But either way, I'm going to be seeing some live fights tomorrow night, whether I'm there in person or likely watching it on NBC.
Well, I'm watching Bellator. No, I might watch this one just because I like both Curtis Stevens and Cunningham. I wonder if this is the first time they fought on the same card. Seems like they were always in separate press releases, but it's the first time I've seen them in one press release. They have such similar names, you know. I always sometimes confuse them. But it's not the only fight going on this weekend. We got a big fight card over in Germany. And we got light heavyweights leading the charge here. Jürgen Bremer, 42-2 with 31 knockouts, is fighting Enzo Macronelli, who's 38-6 with 30 knockouts. All 6 of his defeats have come by way of knockout. And they're fighting for the WBA World Light Heavyweight title. So that's pretty significant odds there. We also have the WBA Intercontinental Light Middleweight title on the line between Jack Colquay, who's 16-1 with 10 knockouts, and Salim Larbi, who's 19-4-2 with 7 knockouts. And way down at the bottom of this card, we have an 8-round heavyweight fight between Kubrat Pulev, 19-0 with 10 knockouts, and our former guest, Joey DeVico, who is 9-3-2 with 3 knockouts. So we're going to be rooting for Joey on that one. Let's see, what else we got for Saturday and Sunday? Got an interesting fight going on in Chihuahua, Mexico. Marco Antonio Rubio will be fighting a 12-round middleweight fight against Domenico Spada. Rubio is 58-6 with 1 draw and 50 knockouts. Spada is 38-4 with 19 knockouts. Also on the card, we've got, that's for the interim WBC middleweight title, by the way, Rubio versus Spada. And we also have super featherweights fighting a 12-rounder for the WBC FECOM Box super featherweight title. We got Juan Jose Montez, 23-4-2 with 14 knockouts, fighting Edgar Monarez, who's 16-2 with 10 knockouts. And also at middleweight, though it doesn't say how many rounds, we've got Marcos Reyes, 30-1, 30 wins, 1 loss, with 23 knockouts, fighting Diozan Matos, who's 32-18 with 26 knockouts. And another big fight card down in Mexico. The main event is a bantamweight fight between Alejandro Gonzalez Jr., 22-0-2 with 14 knockouts, and Juan Alberto Rosas, who's 38-8 with 27 knockouts. That's a 10-rounder. There's also another 10-round light welterweight fight between Maceo Castillo, 26-2 with 24 knockouts, and Aaron Herrera, 25-3 with 17 knockouts. And it keeps on going. We've got Giovanni Segura, flyweight, fighting a 10-rounder against Felipe Salguero. Segura is 31-3-1 with 27 knockouts, and Salguero is 19-5-1 with 14 knockouts. And you got a Jesus fight, of course, in Mexico. So we've got Jesus fight of the week here. Bantamweights, Jesus Ruiz, 31-5-5 with 22 knockouts. fighting Jose Carlos Vargas, who's 13-8-1 with a knockout. Let's see what else we got going on. Nothing really jumping out. Got a fight going on at the Resorts World Casino in Queens, New York. Nothing special on here, but we do have the WBA Fedolatin Super Bantamweight title on the line between Rafael Vazquez, 10-1 with 8 knockouts, and Manuel De Los Reyes Herrera, who's 21-12-1 with 15 knockouts. Nothing really crazy good on that card. That's pretty much it for Sunday, anyway. And we do have a card going on tonight, too. Golden Boy Promotions heavyweight card. Oh, and I mentioned last week, Mundine versus Claudy. That's actually next Wednesday. 12-round light middleweight fight. It's the main event there in New South Wales, Australia. And Mundine is 46-5 with 27 knockouts. Claudy is 37-4 with 22 knockouts. And the fight is for the WBA International Light Middleweight title. We also have Brad Pitt fighting this weekend. But you didn't know Brad Pitt was a boxer.
Fight Club.
And he's 15-0 with 12 knockouts. So he's obviously...
You didn't know he was a fighter? Because rule number one of Fight Club, you don't talk about Fight Club.
You don't talk about his fight. He's fighting David Alawa, who's 10-1 with 7 knockouts, and that is for the OPBF Cruiserweight title. That's the other people's boxing fair. Other David Alawa for that card is a great pop. The other card. And next Thursday we also have another fight at the BB King Blues Club and Grill in New York. It's going to be on GoFightLive.tv. It's put on by DiBella Entertainment. Interesting fight at the main event there is Eric Bone, 13-1 with 7 knockouts, fighting Francisco Figueroa. 20 wins, 6 and 1 draw. And I think we've had Figueroa a couple times in the past. That's pretty much all we've got for the boxing schedule. Going over the MMA stuff. No other notes. I think that's it. You guys have anything?
No, I just want to, Tom, I sent you that article I sent you about, the one I wrote on the Atlas Taylor preview that I did back in 07.
Yeah, so I look forward to it.
I think I was pretty close on it. And then tonight I'm going to do run Atlas too. A few things on my computer, and then I'm going to start getting things prepared for the Pacquiao Bradley preview that I will have out probably Tuesday of next week, a couple days before I leave.
Yeah. All right. Now when are you leaving for now? Well, Tony, when are you leaving for that? Are you going to be leaving the day after the show, or what?
Yeah, I'm leaving Friday morning.
Morning
area, 7:45 shuttle and catch. And take my shuttle. My flight is around 11-ish, I guess. So, and then Vegas time, I'm supposed to land, I guess, around 2.
Yeah.
We were talking about, I was thinking about maybe trying Friday night to get tickets to Mandalay Bay. We have a new card out there because good friend of mine, Dave Price, has one listener that is on, Jesse Hart, Eugene Pedro and Hart's son. I haven't heard back from Dave. And with all the itinerary that we got going over the weekend, it's not going to be easy, you know. I'd like to sneak down to Mandalay, but we got two things going on, so I guess that'll happen. But it was exciting. Like, we were talking just the other day. I was talking to my one friend that I meet, like, one of my college roommates, and he's pumped up. This is his first fight ever. The only fights he's been to were actually some of my amateur fights back in Rock Haven. So he hasn't been to a fight in 98. And we were talking about it. I was not thinking, the fact that we're on a 3-hour time difference out in Vegas. And so he's like, okay, I was like, oh, what do we want to do on Saturday? How are we going to set up our itinerary and stuff like that? And he goes, who do you know that's on the undercard? And I pulled up the box rack because he's like, I can find out the shows that are on the pay-per-view telecast. I said, let's go look on box rack. We looked on there, and we got about 4 or 5 non-televised fights and a couple of good undefeated prospects on there and looking pretty interesting. I'll go over it all next week. And he's like, what I think we should do is go and get a big lunch like a buffet and really load up on lunch. That way, then maybe we'll grab something at the fight at the festival or something, and then maybe go out to dinner after the fight's over. I'm sort of thinking, fight's over, you're getting around midnight. What are we talking about? It's 12:30. East Coast. And because I want to get there, eat lunch early and get there, so maybe we can hang out at the MGM Grand and gamble a little bit, walk to the casino, celebrity watch. And he goes, because the fight card starts at 3. I said, what starts at what? And then, popping into my mind, I've been to big cards in Atlantic City when they're starting. It's 37 o'clock. I'm not equating Pacific time yet. That's cool. You could go out there. Celebrity watch. We're going to have our cameras, take a bunch of photos. And see what it's like. I said, I've been to big fights in Atlantic City. I've been to Scotty Ward. I've been to a Bernard Hopkins fight. And I've been actually two Hopkins fights, one in Reading, PA, and one in Philadelphia, the second. I've been to Vinny Paz versus Dana Rosenblatt. I've been to a Vander Holyfield fight. But this is different because this is Vegas. And I was talking to my mom the other day, laughing almost. When I was 15, and my dad took me to see Michael Moore and Bert Cooper in Atlantic City, and we were coming into the city, about to pull in to where like all the casinos were, and I forget which one it was. I forget if it was Caesar's Palace. I don't remember whether it was the Trump, but I just remember the lights, and I was like, "Oh my God, this is like the biggest thing ever." Now thinking about it, how like really small time Atlantic City is. And that's why I really don't get huge fights anymore, because that's okay for a lot of last week. But I thought it was such big time. And then 2 years later, I'm out in Reno fighting Rich's boy, Brian Carr. And I remember being up in my hotel room, like, overlooking Reno. And I was like, wow. And I thought Atlantic City was amazing. Reno was unbelievable. Well, I guess I'm about to get my mind blown again next week. And I'm looking forward to it.
Yep. Well, we're looking forward to hearing.
Yeah, I mean, believe me, I'm going to have a whole, not only, I mean, I'll have the preview to you guys a few days before I leave. If I don't get it done, I usually get them done on Sunday nights, like the Sunday before. But I'll be at my friend's house for WrestleMania, because I'm a wrestling fan, too. Let's not forget that. All combat sports, even if they're scripted. And, well, what I'll do is I'll have it worked on. If I don't finish it on Saturday, I'll finish it on Monday or Tuesday and have it to you. Right now, the computer hasn't finalized what's going to happen yet. And the computer dictates when it comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I realize you guys are not looking at me while I'm saying it. I'm putting it in my head while I play the computer.
Yeah, exactly. Well, hey, you can't force the computer. It comes when it comes.
Yeah. You told me you think of that Pavlov Taylor article, and you told me how the computer did on that one.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
All right. Well, one more story I did forget to mention. Chris Justino, a.k.a. Cyborg, suffered her first defeat in a long time last Friday night. At Lionside 14, she dropped a unanimous decision in her title fight against opponent Jarena Barnes. The catch is it was a kickboxing Muay Thai match, actually. Jarena Barnes is an undefeated Dutch kickboxer who also has a 35-0-3 record in Muay Thai. She's been out of kickboxing for 3 years, and she faced Cyborg in this fight and rocked her in the first round twice, once with a front kick and again with a head kick. And Barnes continued controlling much of the fight, stifling Cyborg with her rangy jabs and kicks. It looked early on like Cyborg might have gassed out, but she battled back hard in the final two rounds. Just couldn't bridge the gap. In the end, Barnes got the nod from all three judges to the tune of 49-45, 48-45, 49-44. And this was a kickboxing match, not a Muay Thai, sorry. For Barnes, this provides a much-needed reboot to her career. She credits her undefeated record for keeping her out of the ring for nearly 3 years. During that time, amassing a humble 1-3 professional record in mixed martial arts. So we'll see what happens with her. I don't think that's going to affect Justino's chances of fighting Rousey anytime soon, but if Rousey wants to blueprint on how to beat her with striking, I guess you better watch that fight. That's all we've got.
There we go. I would agree. So
thanks, everybody, for stopping by and listening to us, and we'll have our special guest, Steve Schmuger, Tony's favorite referee, next week.
Yeah. All right, guys. Look forward to it.
All right, gentlemen, have a great weekend. Hope you enjoy the fight tomorrow night on NBC. It'll be a good one, and I'll tell you more. You might see me there. If not, I'll be in front of my HD watching it.
Cool. Look forward to it, but okay, over and out.
I'll see you, gentlemen.
Yes, sir. Buenas noches.